Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute, Edelman's Global Research Center for the Study and Cultivation of Trust. I want to welcome you to a special mini-series of the show where we will be recording from the 2022 annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos. Over the next few days, we will be speaking with key figures and experts about this year's forum and gather their insights on our latest Edelman Trust Barometer special report, The Geopolitical Business. To kick us off on our Davos mini-series, I'm joined by historian and economist Adam Tooze. Adam is a renowned global thinker, professor, and director of the European Institute at Columbia University. He is also the host of Foreign Policy's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos, and is the author of Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economy. Adam, welcome to Trustmakers.
Great to be here.
So there's a great thing that you do on your Ones and Twos podcast, which is you use two numbers to frame the conversation. I'm going to borrow that trick if that's okay.
Right.
The first number I'm going to throw at you today is three. That's the number of years you've come to the World Economic Forum's annual meeting at Davos. Mm-hmm. Some of our listeners are highly familiar with Davos, others less so. Can you just kind of explain to people what is Davos?
Well, it's the annual meeting of a thing called the WEF, which is an organization that goes back to the 1970s. And so it's about half a century old at this point. It was founded in the immediate aftermath of the breakup of the global currency system and the oil shock of the period. And it was an initiative by Klaus Schwab and a bunch of, I think, German, European management school people initially to try and drag Europe's management culture and business leadership into engagement with the best ideas that were available around the world. And since then, it's acquired a kind of legendary status as a meeting place of business leaders, politicians, policy wonks, opinion makers, increasingly cultural producers as well, public health people at times, NGOs. Has turned into a kind of a big festival conference of those kind of people from all around the world. The composition tends to shift from year to year, I think, who's here. So over the time that I've been coming, it's been a noticeable shift. The very few Chinese representatives here this year, no one from Russia, obviously. Much stronger representation of Ukraine and Eastern Europe in general is my impression. The meeting reflects the currents of global politics and power as seen from the vantage point of a vaguely transatlantic but quite European-accented vision of elite business, managerial, technocratic culture.
Yeah, and my understanding is the absence of delegates from China is really COVID-related.
Yeah.
You kind of talk about how it's evolved to legendary status and this kind of transatlanticism. Talk a little bit about the ethos behind Davos and maybe kind of where we stand today on that ethos.
Well, I think initially it was very much driven by the idea of productivity and improvement and emulation. And I think those ideas remain core in the sense that it is an organization wedded to the idea of positive sum solutions. I think that's a fair thing to say, right? It is an organization that looks for win-win outcomes. And the win-win outcomes are going to be conditioned, of course, by the size of the cake that there is to be distributed. And so I think the kind of common thread that runs through the Davos history is the search for those kind of deals, not just in a purely economic or technical sense, but more generally, right? I think the kind of Davos ethos is there is no conflict that cannot at some level be softened or compromised or worked through by reasonable people with a common outlook or at least shared objectives getting together and talking things through. At times it has served as a sort of surrogate for diplomacy. The PLO and the Israelis met here. It has a very broad brief, but it does, I think, is rather committed to that idea of the reconcilability and of conflict and the search for positive sum solutions through business. And it reconciles in that sense also, you know, profit with purpose, profit with the idea of progress, and sustainability increasingly is an absolutely core value. I think it's very striking, given how climate has to some extent shifted down the global agenda, how prominent it is at this year's meeting.
I'm curious about this concept of win-win. Mm. You've kind of given a historical perspective on it, but thinking of today, do you feel that is viable? Like, is win-win actually something that can be achieved?
Well, it's a core liberal idea, I think that's fair to say, right? It comes out of an understanding of trade fundamentally that sees trade not as exploitative, but as the matching of preferences and the mutually advantageous exchange of resources or productivity or whatever. And there's a core of truth that remains absolutely sort of solid about that idea, right? There's no question that the interruption of supply chain has made it manifest and painfully obvious to everyone that the global division of labor enormously enhances our well-being. And when that breaks down, you know, everything from merely irritating things to very serious problems arise. But I think what you're driving at is something bigger and broader that has been going on in the world at least for the last 4 or 5 years, which is the sense that common purpose, the project of globalization, not just as a matter of trade relationships and the technicalities of supply chains, but as a kind of a global vision of convergence, common prosperity, as one might say, that has become more and more fragile from a variety of different directions, right? I mean, the sense that increasingly some players in the global system, I think immediately of the United States, have come to understand the key axis of globalization since the 1990s as dangerous and problematic, namely their relationship with China. So they've come to reconstruct their understanding of trade as something that's exploitative and zero-sum, and they accuse the Chinese of massive IP theft. And on the other hand, in a more fundamental sense, the very logic of economic growth has been problematic in that economic growth spills over into other dimensions of potency, of resources, and of power. And so even if you grant that trade is mutually enhancing, it could still be problematic, because if it makes the other power richer, it raises their state potential and their military potential and ultimately gives rise to a great power conflict. So you can reevaluate trade and decide it's actually riskier, or you can still buy the old trade story but still conclude that it's dangerous because it makes the other side, it is positive sum. And to the extent that China rises, this is increasingly seen as a challenge for the United States and its hegemony.
So you're raising some interesting questions about the kind of purpose and ethos behind the annual meeting here at the forum. I'm curious because you mentioned, I think quite rightly, that really in the last 4 years, there's been kind of increased skepticism and kind of writing about stakeholder capitalism and win-win capitalism. Being on the ground here this week, what's your sense of the participants? Like, do you feel like, has their thinking about capitalism evolved or changed? Are they kind of also getting a little bit more skeptical, or are they still very much kind of where they would have been 4 or 5 years ago?
I think there is deep anxiety on several different axes, and for obvious reasons about the war and the implications of the war for the world economy. Notably the spillover effects to commodity and energy prices and the effects of those then on the more vulnerable societies and economies in the world, which should be top of stack. I've had several kind of anxious off-the-record conversations with representatives of EM countries that fall into that category. And then I had a very intense exchange with a leading American investor yesterday, in which he was summoning visions which were positively gothic, I mean, really kind of 19th century visions of social disorder and anxiety about the fraying social contract in the United States. And those concerns, of course, have got back a long way, but for obvious reasons, given the intensification of partisan conflict and dysfunction in American politics, and the fact that we have midterms coming up in 2022 and a presidential election in 2024, which people don't really want to put bets on, you know, the anxiety there is very real. And it's quite striking for a historian, very striking to find very powerful people on the American scene with immense wealth and influence expressing themselves in such concerned terms about really fundamental questions of stability in that country. And of course, America is not just one case. It matters to the entire world because of its sway and its influence. So that has been very striking.
And I'm curious what your reaction to that sentiment is, particularly as a historian. You know, I'd love your kind of like almost stepping back perspective. Like, was the person you're speaking to correct to be that fearful? Have we seen times like these before? What can we learn from history?
I mean, he himself was drawing very strong analogies from history. That's part of his kind of model and understanding of the world. And as a historian, of course, I appreciate that when people, you know, take an interest in history. I'm frankly a little skeptical about the relevance of those kind of models. I mean, this is what struck me about it was precisely the sense of kind of almost anachronistic shock. This is how the haute bourgeoisie, you know, spoke about their situation in Emile Zola novels in France in the late 19th century, or Chekhov play or something like that. You know, the peasants are suddenly out there and going to kind of rumble in on us. It was really extraordinarily graphic. And at that point, I do kind of want to, you know, wake up back into 2022. And on the one hand, of course, recognize the extreme polarization and inequality that does exist. And this is a profoundly, you know, destabilizing force and an extreme reality about the world, which one should in no way soften. But, I mean, is the result of that just simply suffering, dysfunction? That seems to me far more probable than some sort of scenario of revolutionary upheaval. And that's where I feel, as it were, we're in the wrong mental space. Because that does feel to me anachronistic as a vision of the situation. I mean, the problem, I think, more is not really one of a kind of rupture, or, you know, if to put it in terms of like the relationship terms, you know, the problem is really not one of divorce or like femicide or, you know, abuse or something. The question is really just one of an appallingly bad marriage that will persist over long periods of time and from which there is no escape. You know, that seems to characterize our situation better to my mind. I don't expect the big collapse. What I anticipate is, I'm not optimistic about the future, but I'm not apocalyptic in that sense of believing there's going to be this sort of big breakdown. And that it was very striking to encounter it so explicitly spelled out.
Yeah, and I'm curious then, what's business's role in keeping this order together, about perhaps avoiding the almost apocalyptic vision that you and this person spoke about here? Talk about what you think the role of business is and should be.
Well, it's worth differentiating because the person I was speaking to is a big money investor, not a CEO. And I think that's a huge difference, right? Because the big money investor's position in the world is, after all, to some degree mobile. They can be in or they can be out. You know, there's a sort of degree of flexibility there. And whereas the CEO actually has to operate a company in the United States right now, we're now the other advanced society facing these kind of problems, have, I think, a much more embedded sense of challenges on the one hand, but also stability on the other. And I think that is a really useful corrective, the sense that, you know, the ongoing enterprise of managing businesses, producing goods, delivering services, that continues. And to my mind, that gives rise to a very different vision of the world, not necessarily easier. In fact, in many ways, it's more complicated. I'll never get over that famous Jamie Dimon quote where he says, you know, to run my business right now, you need a psychiatrist and a lawyer. Like, you cannot do my... But, and that's always, you know, for him, that was this expostulation. Oh my God, how do I have to live in this world? On the other hand, that's kind of sane. To navigate the modern world, that's exactly what you do need. Like, that's, you know, frankly, sign up, right? That is what we're going to need. And that is the world of management, of conflict mitigation through lawyering and getting our heads straight through whatever, you know, therapeutic mechanisms we need. That, to me, is a very realistic description of our world, rather than the prophets of doom scenario or the fleeing to some safe, neutral space, which was ultimately this investor's advice, is find a place of neutrality. And my response was like, well, that'd be nice.
Well, we are in Switzerland.
Yeah, well, but look where Switzerland's turned out in this war, right? Even Switzerland has, to a degree, sacrificed the sort of position that it's sometimes taken, right? It's had to take sides. Neutrality was something that I think the forum hoped to create and was quite successful at creating. Then for a while it was on a high in the sense that, as it were, the world had been neutralized to a considerable extent by the project of globalization, and some might say by the unipolar American power. Now we're no longer in that world. So this project of, I think what we should be engaged in is perhaps creating zones, if not of neutrality, then at least pragmatic cooperation, agreement on certain metrics. That's why for me climate remains oddly salient and relevant and crucial, because we think of it as the ultimate problem, the one we can't solve. But in a sense, if we're all gnawing away at it collectively, that's something. And in the world that we're currently in, having a problem we're all collectively gnawing away at is a win, right? It's something to treasure. If we can agree that CO2 reduction and the end of the internal combustion engine is something that we can work with China on, we can work with Detroit on, we can work in Europe on this problem, with Japan, with South Korea, and that ultimately those vehicles have to be made available to emerging market and low-income countries, hey, you know, sign me up. That is a problem we should work on.
Well, I love that now that we're in person doing this podcast, I can see the excitement and happiness in your voice and on your face now. And look, one of the things that we've been finding for a while in the Edelman Trust Barometer is the expectation of business and business leaders to get involved in major societal issues, particularly climate. The report that we come to Davos with this year on the geopolitical business leads me to our second number. That number is 59. That's the percentage of respondents who say that now geopolitics is the responsibility of business, in addition to things like sustainability and reskilling. What do you see as the role of business in geopolitics, and is that something that you've seen evolving?
I mean, it's fascinating that that should have happened, and it entirely concords with my impressionistic analysis, and I've been fascinated by this problem now since really 2016, 2017. It seemed to me it was heaving into view as a major issue. And this goes directly to this point of neutrality, right? Because the business person's fantasy, I think, is to operate in a neutral world, you know, because then you can get on with doing what you want to do, which is making money by making sensible investments in things that people want to buy, or that at least you can find customers for. And that is, as it were, you know, the baseline and the hope. And the world that we're in right now provides precious few easy plays in that respect. And if you're operating a multinational business, you're in a very, very complex environment. And there's no, I think, any hope of moving out of that anytime soon. I'm struck that you say it's the responsibility of business, because that takes us into the realms of, you know, when businesses perform and do geopolitics, we're talking imperialism. I mean, that's what the West thought One Belt, One Road was on the Chinese side, to not go any deeper in history than that, right? Or before 1914, European arms manufacturers were closely tied up with global diplomacy and alignments of diplomatic alliance and manufacturing interests converged in imperialism in its classic form. That is a really complex, dangerous, explosive logic, if that's where we go. If geopolitics becomes the responsibility of business, we're in an even more heightened sense of tension, right? Because then private interests, profit interests, intersect with power and states directly. And there are zones where undeniably that happens. But I think right now most businesses would say that wasn't our plan. We may have geopolitical effects. So if you're in the business of exporting extremely high-tech, one in the world, you know, lithograph machines to China for the production of microchips, you are having a geopolitical effect, whether you like it or not, in the eyes of the American defense establishment at this moment. And they will come and tell you that very quickly if you're doing that kind of business. And they will then ask you to choose sides and to line up. And at that point, you're doing geopolitics, but at the behest of the American Defense Department, which is saying, folks, we don't want those kind of things being sold to that client anymore, and we'd really like you to check in with all the clients you customer future have. And if we do that, we're all good. And if we don't do that, we're taking all the promises off the table, right? And that is the situation, I think, in which many businesses now find themselves, where their activities, which were normally just neutral and were just fine, all of a sudden take on a real salience that is new. Then you have the instance of, say, a bank that tries to straddle the world between Asia and Europe, situates itself, say, for sake of argument, in Hong Kong, and finds itself now facing demands from major shareholders in China saying, look, you cannot function like this. You cannot straddle the Asian, mainland Chinese and Western market anymore. We're going to have to talk about corporate structure. So at that point, geopolitics is coming to the business and saying, your business structure doesn't work. Like, with the supplier of lithograph machines, you can say, well, there's a way out for you here, and there's a safe space, and we'll offer you it. It's not neutral, but you'll be in our camp, and we're your friends, and so you should stay with us. This other one is basically saying that as an entity, as a corporation, perhaps as a legacy of imperialism yourself, situated the way you are, you have no future, right, as the entity that you are. Now, that doesn't necessarily, it's no catastrophe for the investors. You can sell these parts off. You know, there may be greater value in the two separate bits. This isn't an expropriation. Right now, it's not an expropriation, but it's at least a geopolitical death sentence on that particular corporate structure. We're seeing an incredible variety of different things being played out here, or huge, you know, challenges to the investment position and long-term globalization strategies of European players in Russia, who now have to rebalance and rethink their entire portfolio, or that innocent manufacturing plant you had in a particularly sensitive bit of China, where, again, you hadn't thought much about it, but it turns out to be really rather a big deal. And at the same time, when you're thinking about EV and the global energy transition, we all know there is no strategy beyond China. China is the biggest, most rapidly growing market for cars, especially of the EV type, and so you really can't be in that transition if you're not there. So, mind-blowing set of problems.
Mind-blowing set of problems. Okay, now let's look at solutions a little bit. And if you were giving advice more to leaders of multinationals in this incredibly complex environment with rising expectations around social issues and geopolitics, help.
Yes.
What's some of the things you would tell them?
I think you have to reevaluate the function of politics at this point, because what you urgently, urgently need is responsible politics. Because you should not, this is where I would push back, you should not expect to be able to do this yourself. You can't. This is not for you to do, right? You need to recognize, and if you find yourself doing it, you should have a long, hard look at the business that you're in and go, hang on, this is absolutely not the territory that we should be in. And this is a very far-reaching comment. It sounds platitudinous, but you know, if we think, for instance, of the people who bought large and substantial portfolios of Russian government bonds in the last 10 years, one does really have to ask why they didn't read the substantial sections which spelled out the geopolitical risks and what those implications were. And it wasn't simply a matter of what they would lose if things went belly up, but why on earth they were putting money into loans to a government which was exposed to that kind of risk. Right? I mean, this is... people need to smarten up very dramatically, and they also need to look for help, because they should not be attempting to do this themselves. That is down that path. That's the road to perdition, fundamentally. So you need to be able to count on the functioning in the West, on the functioning and the sophistication of democratic politics. And that, I think, is a very profound reason to be deeply worried about the situation in the United States, because if you do not have stable, responsible, coherent, it doesn't have to be visionary, but it has to offer some kind of view of the future, a plausible future, with regards to challenges which the vast majority of us treat as serious, like climate. How does an American corporate align on climate in the current moment, given the total uncertainty of American national politics? How do you honor your obligations to your shareholders when you don't know what the legislative framework is going to be and you have a fiduciary obligation to maximize return? These are only if you have responsible politics that says, yes, we're going to square this for you. These are your obligations. This is where you're free. Are you really able to adopt a responsible position? So in this sense, corporations, and they discovered that after all in the US in the fall of 2020, have a vast vested interest in high-functioning, rule of law, predictable, modern polities.
So companies have a vested interest in that, and our research has shown that business is much more trusted than government, but also seen as way more competent and more ethical. Considering what's happening in the US, should U.S. multinationals somehow get engaged in helping to fix and stabilize the U.S. political system, or should they sit on the sidelines and just hope it works itself out?
The very first thing they can't do is to indulge themselves in the fact that they won that race. That is not where you want to be. You know, you want your public institutions to enjoy unquestioned in authority, and you should be bowing down before them because they are the representatives of the public good.
I love you saying that. Whenever I'm standing in front of a group of business leaders and say, you're the most trusted, I have to quickly end that ellipse with, I don't think that's necessarily good news for you.
This is not where you want to be in a race to the bottom, right? One thing I think you need to think very hard about is, how do you exercise self-restraint? Because the problem in America, I mean, I'm going to use this phrase because Warren Buffett said it. And if Warren Buffett said it, I can say it. I mean, when Warren Buffett was asked, is the class war in American society? His answer was, yes, there is. My side has been waging it and we've won. And this has created a spectacular, he said this several times, including to the New York Times. And it is so starkly revealing of the situation that we're in, right? Because what we need to surely ask of business is that it, especially in the US, is that it uses the incredible space for influence, manipulation, sponsorship, and so on that American politics currently affords it in a way that goes beyond the narrow self-interest of the business that they are in, right? So think very hard about what lobbying does and how corrosive it is of precisely the reputation and the authority of the political system. Because if you don't think that, don't then come whining and complaining about the dysfunction of Congress if you yourself are contributing to its destabilization. Now, this may, in a sense, require you to proactively refuse offers of access and so on that are made to you by the system. It requires a kind of principled position that says we will not contribute to the further deterioration of this very fragile system. And that is asking for something that we've rarely seen, if ever, right? I mean, but we are in a pretty extreme situation.
Well, it's kind of mind-blowing, because if I'm reading you correctly, you're almost saying the best way to engage with government is to first disengage with the way you have been engaging with government.
Stop breaking the system or making its problems worse, and then take a truly clear-eyed and strategic view of what the forces of stability, progress, and good governance ultimately are in American society. And I'm, talking my book here to an extent, because my view is that long-term orientated strategic thinking, American capital, has a profound interest in the emergence of a centrist and, broadly speaking, center-left orientated coalition, because its diagnosis of the fundamental structural problems facing American society and the world more generally is much better than the alternative provided by conservatives. It's from a purely realistic point of view. If you are concerned about social integration, if you're concerned about environmental sustainability, if you're concerned about foreign policy that does not lead us into escalatory spirals of militarism, I got to break it to you, but the smart money is not on the right wing, the right spectrum of the political of politics, and that's a surprise, right? It's a surprise, but hey, you've got to roll with what history gives you, and it's very difficult to my mind to disagree with this. And this is a shock; it's a cultural shock, but it's not by accident, after all. And I'm sorry to be partisan here and party political, but it's a remarkable historical fact that the relationships between the GOP and the senior national corporate and global corporate leadership in the United States have become as fragile as they have.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the most shocking findings that we've seen this calendar year in trust is the incredible drop in trust in business amongst Republicans in the U.S.
And it's mutual, yeah? And this is, as we see, like Disney. I mean, the world in which Disney, like, everyone's idea of the purveyor of American soft power and the success of commercial culture is now at war with substantial parts of the Republican Party. How on earth did this happen? If you'd written that script 5 years ago, a historian would have said you lost your marbles. This is insane. We understand surely how this works, but no. So when domestic culture wars take on that kind of quality. And we saw this in the United States, right? It's not for nothing that we saw very substantial numbers of extremely senior business leaders in the United States solidarizing themselves with the Black Lives Matter movement. Because they understand if you're running a big corporation in a diverse society, you have to align with what is understood to be the best hope of a more equitable and therefore also more peaceful society.
Gosh, Adam, I feel lucky because we can actually continue this conversation once the recording stops. But for our listeners, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for listening to The Trustmakers. And Adam, thank you for being our in-person guest at Davos.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.